The following program is brought to you by Podcast One Sportsnet.
This episode of the Steve Austin Show is sponsored in part by Hims, the wellness brand for the modern man. Go to forhims.com/unleashed to receive a trial month of hair loss prevention products for just $5.
The following program is a podcast1.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Steve Austin Show. I am sitting here with a microphone in my hand, conducting the open this podcast, and I think you're going to enjoy today's guest. Finally, after 4 years, well, I've been in podcast business 5 years. Chris has been in it 4 years. Finally, the one and only Chris Jericho stops by 317 Gimmick Street so he can be a guest on my podcast. Way back in the day when Chris started his podcast, I believe that's been about 4 years. I think he's got about 430 episodes out now. I was a guest on his first two shows when he started podcasting, and obviously, you know, he's come a long way since then. He's got an extremely popular podcast. I'm real happy for his success. Finally, he gets a chance to return the favor and be a guest on my show. Always like talking to Chris, one of the hardest working guys I know, one of the smartest guys in the wrestling business and pretty much entertainment business. He always stays on top of things. He's a hardworking guy. He stopped by the crib, and man, we just had a good time catching up. You know, we talk on this podcast for about an hour, hour and 20 minutes, give or take, and then we shut down the microphones, and you can hear me as a guest on his podcast talking about music. I think I even sang part of a few songs. And as you can see, that's why I didn't pursue a career in the music business, because I cannot sing. But I tell you what, when we shut down the microphones and just shot the breeze, that's what was really fun. And next time Chris rolls into town, I think we're just going to kick back and have a couple of cold ones and shoot the breeze. It's always good catching up with one of my brothers that spent so much time in the ring in the squared circle doing what I chose to do. And my passion is their passion. It's just a mutual love and just the brothers and the sisters from being inside that squared circle is a special bond. Chris Jericho is my guest today, and I'm not going to ramble on a bunch of horseshit today. I've been getting a lot of tweets, though, and emails about my feed. My show has kind of been morphed into one. I guess basically everything is kind of a family-friendly show now. We're not dropping so many F-bombs. I got a lot of questions about that. Tons of emails, tons of tweets. It just seems to be that it's a little bit easier to sell ads and stuff like that when you're dealing with a family-friendly type format. And yeah, there'll be a few odd cuss words there, here and there, and stuff like that, but the F-bombs are kind of gone. And that's just kind of what happened, and that's about as far as I can explain it. I'm really actually quite fine with that. I have a great conversation with Jim Florentine last Tuesday and Chris Jericho. I don't really have to cuss that much to have a good time. But that's the answer to the question. If any of you guys are asking, or if anybody's curious, it's all been morphed into one feed, and it is what it is. I still continue to open two cans of audio whoop ass with four-letter words or not. But I just wanted to take a quick minute to explain that to you, and that's about all I've delved into it. I hadn't done all the research on it, but that's what's being told to me, and that's how it's happening, and I'm totally cool with it. Before we get to my guest, Y2J, Chris Jericho, let me tell you guys about Hims. It's a new year. It's 2018, and chance to make a new impression. That means keeping your hair in order and becoming the handsomest SOB the world has ever seen. The bottom line is, men want to keep their hair and take care of themselves. Now, hassle-free prevention and solutions now exist with Hims. Hims is a wellness brand for the modern man. A one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and sexual wellness. Making men's personal care trusted, easy, and affordable. Hims offers FDA-approved medical-grade products, personalized recommendations, plus convenient, confidential online consultation with a licensed doctor. There are no pharmacy lines, no waiting rooms. The products are shipped directly to your door. And Hims passes big savings along to you, offering prescription and generic for just a fraction of the price. Sound treatment and prevention backed by medicine and science. Look better, feel better, do better with Hims. For listeners of the Steve Austin Show Unleashed, get a trial month of everything you need to keep your hair for just $5 while supplies last. This would cost you hundreds of dollars if you went to a doctor's office or a pharmacy. So what are you waiting for? Save some damn money and save your damn hair. Just go to forhims.com/unleash for all the details. That's forhims.com/unleash and stomp a mud hole into hair loss and walk it dry. One more time, that's forhims.com/unleash to get yourself a trial month for just $5.
Hey, it's Rob Riggle.
And Sarah Tiana.
And you are listening to Riggle's Pick.
Yeah, and a ham horn, and we have a new podcast. You can find our show exclusively on the Podcast One app on PodcastOneSports.com, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Every Thursday, we're going to sit around and we're going to talk about the things that really excite us, like life, comedy, sports, a lot of sports.
Ourselves.
A lot of Sarah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope you join us.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Hell, I'm sitting here rolling sound, 317 Gimmick Street. Chris Jericho, Y2J, sitting right in front of me. Jesus H. Christ on a popsicle stick. I ain't seen you in a long ass time.
You know, it's funny, and this happens to me quite a bit when I see the boys that I hadn't seen for a while. I forget just how big everyone is from the Attitude Era compared to me. Because now on the show, everybody's kind of the same size. But as soon as I saw you, it's been, gosh, I don't know, 5-6 years. And it's like, oh, my God, like Austin's huge. I mean, you look great, but you're tall. Like even with the Hardys, I saw Matt and Jeff the first time in a few years. I couldn't believe how tall they were. But yeah, man, it's great to see you. And I never knew that I hadn't done your show. I thought I'd done it before.
No, dude. Actually, there was a little bit of a beef. Because this between you and me, nobody knows. Well, you didn't even know. I called you or sent you some text messages because I know you're going to be in, or you told me you're going to be in LA,
mm-hmm.
but you're filming one of your rock videos for Fozzy.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, hey, man, I'll come by the set if you don't mind and we can knock out a podcast. And you blew me off, or you had other things to do.
I can't remember
not
that.
Not intentionally.
I would never blow you off.
Yeah. But I'm just saying,
yeah.
They didn't have nothing. Like, God dang, I was kind of perturbed. Because I was like, I did his first two shows. Guys got it. You got to return the favor.
You got me, pretty much got me hooked up with the gig. I mean,
yeah.
You were the one who was the contact that took me there. So, like I said, I had thought for sure that I had done it. And when you said I still owe you one, I'm like, oh, man, this is a debt that has to be repaid.
I know it is. It's one of those things where I'm so bad about holding a grudge. It's like, God dang, Chris has kayfabed me on the show. I got heat with this guy.
But see, I don't even remember that I would have loved to have you come to the set. I'm not sure what happened. Maybe we were busy filming or something.
Dude,
but
you know how the boys get. I mean, it's
yeah.
You know, halftime, it's interesting. I don't know how you are with this. And to everybody out there listening, we'll probably talk about wrestling in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always
we'll get
funny,
there.
Dude, when you get around the boys, sometimes you just want to catch up and just talk about
mm-hmm.
shit. And Chris is over at the house for about 30 minutes. We was drinking coffee, talking about labs. I can't believe you got a silver lab and a black lab just like I got.
I walked through your door, the gate that you have, and I saw the front door. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I saw a silver lab and a black lab, and I saw your wife. And I was like, is that a silver? Oh, yeah. We just got them. 2 months ago at the same time. So it blew me away. It's the exact same pairing, except for my black lab's a boy and yours is a girl.
So we got that going for us. But, you know, it's like I'd ask you a couple times and you're busy or whatever, life happens.
And vice versa.
And you know, so, but then it's also kind of like, you know, you do really well at spreading yourself around, and you're traveling a lot more
mm-hmm.
than I am.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you've got your rock and roll connections, you've got your wrestling connections, you've got those out there connections. Me, I really like talking to the boys. You know, I can spend a lot of time talking to some of these cats. I don't think every A-lister in L.A. is going to come over here to 317 Gimmick Street and shoot the breeze with me,
mm-hmm.
Nor do I really want to shoot the breeze with them.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's like, you know, it's cool to ask somebody if you want to be on a show, but when you keep asking, when they're a good guest or you enjoy talking to them, you almost like, I feel like I'm imposing my friendship on them, or it's like, eh, you know, that hold up that crucifix because Dracula's there.
Right. Well, it's one of those
things. Are you like that? Or he's like,
absolutely.
Hey, man, anybody want to do it?
I was just talking this morning to some people, and I was telling them I've become that guy that because I'm so podcast-centric, I could meet like, for example, I did a show for TBS called Drop the Mic. It's like a battle rap show. And the host is Method Man from Wu-Tang Clan. And he's hey, Jericho, what a guy. I'm a big fan. So automatically, you should do my podcast. In 3 seconds of meeting this guy. And I think a lot of people would be very honored by that. And other people would be like, you just said, like, calm down, dude. Like, I just met you. Yeah. It's like meeting a girl for the first time going, let's go make out. Like, I like to kiss. So I think, I just get excited at the concept of talking to these different people that when am I ever going to see Method Man again?
Right.
You know, and it turned out that a week later we had a show in Long Island. I went to Staten Island. I did the show at his house. We had a blast. It was a great conversation. But I always think in that way, and I'm sure it does turn some people off, and it has. But it's, you know, I think for the most part, people enjoy talking to someone that they either respect. There's mutual respect. Obviously, Steve Austin asks, you know, somebody from this generation to be on the show. They're going to bend over backwards to do it because it's Stone Cold Steve Austin. So I think it's an honor for some people to do it, and maybe a little bit of a hardship, but if they really like you, they'll do it.
Yeah, it is a funny thing because every time WWE, or most of the times when WWE comes through town, you know, some of the guys or girls will give me a heads up they're coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew Bailey was in town one time. She was working with her CrossFit coach. And I said, hey, man, you want to come over and do a show? And she did, because I really like her. I like Sasha.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming back through town. I said, hey, you want to come by and do the show? And so they did, and she had to go do a meet and greet. And so then I hung out with Sasha and we did a show, and I got to talk with Bailey for about 30 minutes, kind of a three-people conversation.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, she said, hey, man, it was good seeing you. And then she said, maybe like next time we can just hang out. And I was like, oh, yeah. I said, man, that'd be great. Just drink a beer or whatever and just shoot the breeze. Because, you know, things change when you hit the record button, Chris.
Yeah.
You can get some honest come to Jesus interviews.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hit the off button, just like some of the stuff we talked about over at my house.
Some stuff you don't want everybody to know.
You don't want everybody
to
know.
But one of the things I liked about the podcast at first is it gave me a chance to, gave me an excuse, for example, to get together with my friends. This perfect example right now to do a podcast. But at work too, like, you know, I remember the first time I had Triple H on. You know, I'd never talked to Triple H for an hour and a half before. Never had the chance. Usually he's doing one thing, I'm doing another thing. Maybe you'd put together a match. But to actually sit down and talk for an hour and a half, it was a lot of fun. And I like that about the people that I know in bands, behind the backstage wrestling. But even, like, we all grew up, for example, fans of the Fonz, Henry Winkler. I got invited to do a Comic-Con, and I don't do them a lot, but as I always said, who else is on the show? If there's somebody else on the show that I want to interview, and you can get me an interview with that guy, I'll come do the Comic-Con. And Henry Winkler was on. I said, I want Henry Winkler, and the guy was able to work it out. I got a chance to sit down with Henry Winkler for 45 minutes, like my childhood hero, and Paul Stanley too. Those two guys were like right up there for me, and Hulk Hogan. And to get sit down with these guys and actually talk to them one-on-one, undivided attention, nobody's coming in to, you know, we got to do this. That to me is the best part of podcasting. I would almost do it for free for those reasons.
Yeah, and that's cool when you mention people like that, but you know, when people from our business, it's like, if they're currently in the system and employed, well, you're kind of a free agent.
Mm-hmm.
But someone that's, you know.
Yeah, so there, yeah.
they're in the trenches.
Yeah.
Well, if you ask Big Show, because I talked to him on the podcast, on the Stone Cold podcast, he'll straight up tell you, I ain't being booked worth a shit.
You know,
and get away with it.
He don't care.
Yeah.
Right.
And but you just can't do that.
But you can't say that if you're, you know, Bailey, for example. I mean, you got to watch what you say because they're watching you. You know what I mean? At all times, even if you don't think they are.
Well, they're listening. They're watching. Yeah,
they'll find out. You know, the boss will find out. And I often wonder, it's not even wonder, I'm sure it happens where he probably gets a report every day. Here's the social media report. Here's the Twitter report. Here's the podcast report. This person said this or that person said that. I don't know, but I would think, like, you know, whenever we were in Madison Square Garden back in the day doing house shows and Vince would always go to the garden and sometimes he wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was always there. I'm sure there was times he was hiding up in the rafters like the Phantom of the Opera watching the show to see how the guys worked when they didn't think he was there.
That's,
you know what I mean?
That's an interesting concept.
And I even said that to him once. I said the same thing, used the Phantom of the Opera. And of course he gave me the Vince laugh and kind of just didn't answer and walked away.
What's the Vince laugh?
Phantom of the Opera. And that's it.
Yeah.
There's no answer either way. I'm like, okay. And it's like that. I don't know for sure, but I'm sure they have people who are watchdogs. Because you get some of these guys that go on and they talk really bad shit on Twitter, which is the worst place you can do it, thinking that no one in the company is going to read it and go, you know what? If that's the way you feel, then go away.
Right.
Let's see what happens to you, buddy, you know?
It was interesting when I'd been trying to get Gallows and Anderson to be on a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the time they were set a couple of months ago, man, Gallows got stranded and just because they live in different locations.
Yeah.
And so he got stranded and it blew the podcast off. And I'd been really wanting them on the show. Finally, they made it. And I said, man, I said, you know, if you guys want to sit down, have a couple of beers or whatever, you know, and I'll have some of my beer. But what do you guys drink? Because you might not like my beer. And I said, well, you know, Bud Light. So I had a case of Bud Light. I had a case of Miller Light, you know, on backup as another flavor, some Broken Skull IPA. Rocky Romero was here with Gallows Anderson. And
yeah.
I'd never heard any of you guys' podcasts, but I heard they were like a riot. And I guess you guys, I don't know, it was them that invented the term. Well, it's been around forever.
Talking shop. Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I was like, you start off with some ABC shit, but I knew it was just going to be a laugh fest. So, man, those guys were absolutely awesome. And so that was a case where on my Unleashed show, which is unfiltered, uncensored, anything goes, like, okay, it's cool for me to be as profane or whatever as I want to be, but I don't know that because you guys are in the PG system, what your language parameters are. Of course,
right.
One thing after another, dude, this whole table, I took a picture on my Twitter account. It was a case and a half of beer, Broken Skull IPA. Rocky Romero was drinking my beer with me, and those guys were just drinking, you know, reading novels like it was water. And it was Katie bar the door. And that was an awesome session.
I said to both those guys, because I just met them when they came to WWE, I think in 2015 or 16, whatever it was. I said, you know, I thought for a long time that I was the biggest piece of shit I'd ever met in this business. And then I met you two guys. And now I know I'm not the biggest piece of shit in the business. But those two guys, we had so much fun because they go back to the days of, like, you know, when we were talking about how it was for us, when everybody was super crazy and a lot of it was dangerous because there was a lot of drugs. These guys are not drugs, it's drinking, but they have so much fun. And that, to me, it was so much fun to be around them and be on the road with them. It reignited my love for being on tour as well, meeting a couple of kindred spirits like those guys.
And they told me that same story.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, like someone passing a torch or like,
yeah, totally,
like,
yeah, right.
Hey, goddammit, it's cool to see someone that's as out there as I was
completely.
Or am.
Completely. You know, we would do Talk and Shop, which was there was the worst podcast ever they would do in Japan. They told me about it the first time I had them on backstage, San Diego Coliseum. And I said, well, we should do a Talk and Shop, you know, presented by Talk is Jericho. Like, what do you guys do? He's like, we just pick a night when we're going to be somewhere together and we'll just start drinking and see what happens. Okay. We go to Honolulu. It was going to be me, Gallows, and Anderson. We got there early. We're going to go walk down the beach, check out some places. 7 hours later, we're still at the same damn beach bar. Johnny Ace has passed out because of us. We're still awake. Let's go do a podcast. Bring in AJ Styles, who's Uncle Alan, to those guys, AKA Malibu Al, because that's all he drinks is Malibu rum. And we had this freaking podcast that was the most ridiculous. Like, you're almost like, what the hell is going on? There's nothing going on. No one's listening to anybody else. Everyone's interrupting everybody else. The security's knocking on the door, so we bring the microphone out, talk to them. This podcast did like 1 million downloads.
Yeah.
People loved it. And then we did Talk and Shop Australia, Talk and Shop China, Talk and Shop Nuremberg, Germany. And that one was the worst. We were so drunk. You can't even listen to it. But Gallows plays this character called Reptile.
That guy's an idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a compliment. He's hilarious.
You'll love this, though. So he plays this character called Reptile. Like, hey, my name is Reptile. I'm a luchador. I'm here to do some things. Because all they do is voices.
Yeah.
Sour Boy, Hell Yeah Man, you know, Mountain Man, like Gordy Canuck. So he's doing this Reptile. So we always have a rotating fourth. And the rotating fourth at this point is Primo Colon, Carlos's son. So we call Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico, and Eddie's like, hey, Pops, I got this guy. His name is Reptile. He wants to get booked. And Carlos is like, who is he? Yeah, he's a pretty good kid. And he wants to talk. So Gallows gets on the phone with Carlos Colon, the legendary Carlos. Like, my name is Reptile. I like to do the Tolkienana, the Topes. I like to do the coat-to-coat juice. And Carlos Colon's like, who is this guy? Primo's like, you know, he talks to him for a bit. And if I go, so what do you think, Pops? Is he booked? And Carlos's like, sure, whatever. So we actually got Reptile booked in Puerto Rico with Carlos Colon. But like you said, like these guys, they are a perfect example, like Dean Malenko, like Brad Armstrong, of these guys that are so funny backstage, but haven't found a way to transfer that on screen yet.
How do you figure that is? Because you just mentioned Dean Malenko is just one of the fastest guys on a verbal conversation, just popping you.
So funny.
Yeah. And Brad Armstrong could light up any dress room.
Yeah.
Supremely funny.
Yeah.
But and also highly respected as a worker in any style.
Technicians, yeah.
And Dean Malenko, man of a thousand holes. And, of course, you were man of a thousand and one. We're going to talk about
although now I'm down to about 235 at this ridiculous. Point in time. I forgot a lot.
Okay.
And just to answer your question quickly, you said, why is that? I think some guys, like you mentioned, sorry to interrupt, but no, what you mentioned when the red light is on, I think a lot of guys weren't comfortable playing a character that wasn't like Dean was trained by his dad, very serious, very much exchanging holds, Carl Gotch, that sort of thing. I don't think he ever felt comfortable letting go and being funny Dean in the ring, because I don't think he was not taught that way. And Brad, I think, was the same. Some guys just don't have, like you said, when you turn the recorder on, it's a different conversation when the recorder is off.
But I mean, they were still spectacular in the ring, though. But it almost kind of gives me a parallel into another business or living or passion that you're in, is rock and roll music. So, you know, you see, let's take, for instance, a band that would be technically extremely good, but didn't have a run that they should have had. Okay, like Dream Theater comes immediately to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, great band.
Yeah.
Great band, wouldn't you agree? Should have had a bigger run.
Well, here's one thing I've learned over the years, because, excuse me, I was a huge Dream Theater fan from about 94 to 2004, like one of my top three bands. But then you grow older and you realize it's like the best band of all time is AC/DC. I've learned that from being in a band and from watching bands.
My wife is going to tell you Rush.
Well, the thing is, Rush is great. Dream Theater is great, but it's a style of music based around playing, based around, you know, it's like wrestling. It's like going to a Lucha Libre match. How many flips and flops and flies can you do until it just starts running together? Now, if you're into that sort of thing, Dream Theater is the best of the best.
Right.
It's incredible what they can do, and nobody can touch them. But there's something, why didn't they get a bigger run? Because it's a very limited style of music. I can't play Dream Theater for my wife. She doesn't want to hear a 10-minute song.
Yeah.
She wants to hear a 30-minute, you know, guitar solo. Whereas AC/DC, 3-minute punch, it's sex. It's like Steven Tyler used to say, it's fucking music. It's music you can get off to. That appeals to everybody.
Interesting.
Yeah. I just think that when you're talking about, like, Rush was a little bit more accessible because they had a little bit more of a pop element. Dream Theater won't do that. And that's why Dream Theater, they've had a huge run for who they are as a band. Had they done a couple more fly-by-night type songs, for example, you know, Closer to the Heart maybe type of a thing that Rush did, they might have been a little bit bigger. But the time when they tried that, the fans revolted. They didn't want to hear Dream Theater do that. Whereas Rush had 40 years of having all these different styles, so they could go play, you know, La Strangiata, you know, 14-minute instrumental, and you go nuts. And then they play Closer to the Heart, and you go nuts as well. Tom Sawyer.
That's again, but because everything's so subjective, I think it's whatever the crowd is in unison or from the biggest piece of the pie, you know, what people are looking for.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I mean, are you looking for technical excellence? Or are you looking for or technical sound? Or are you looking for entertainment, or someone just grabs you by the throat? For instance, Stone Cold. Stunning Steve, didn't really grab too much. But Stone Cold, I finally came up with the right gimmick, had enough talent, was a good enough mechanic, timing. But here's another band, and I don't know if you ever, and we're going to shift off of music because I want to talk to you about your ladder match with Shawn Michaels, and I want to talk about Alpha Omega and some other things. But were you ever into at all Y&T from San Francisco?
Never really, and I'll tell you the reason why. Because I know a lot of people like Eddie Trunk, our merch girl in Europe. Well, actually, she's now Zach's personal assistant. She will be Y&T for life, and she's 30 years old. For me, when I got into real deep into music, Y&T was going through their glam phase of
Summertime
Lipstick
Girls.
And Leather, Summertime Girls, Contagious. So they just came across as like Bon Jovi light to me. I never got into the Mean Streak, Black Tiger,
that's what
late
I
70s,
on.
Early, and I missed that. To say that, I missed UFO, I missed Scorpions with Uli John Roth. And if you go to a Scorpion show, like I went with Scott Ian before, Kirk Hammett, those guys worship at the feet of 70s Scorpions. I'm like, I don't get it. I like 80s Scorpions, because that's when I came in.
I'm with that.
So I never got into the Y&T because of that, because I just thought they were kind of Bon Jovi light, and never bothered to delve back further into their catalog.
God dang, but Dave Menichetti with the vocal talent and a guitar talent, a double threat.
Well, yeah, and still well respected to this day. I mean, he's the last remaining original member in the band. They still tour and they still, you know, do good business, especially in Europe. But it's just one of those bands that missed for me. I never got it.
You know what I think about that? I was thinking, okay, it was a unique sound. It's not for everybody. It's not like you said, to your point, AC/DC. When you hear AC/DC, dude, I mean, if you have any metal in you at all, it's really hard not to like that. Mm. So if you have any rock and roll in you at all, you know, Y&T just might not float your boat.
Well, you know,
I think it was the gimmick. Y&T. It's hard for me to, you know, I got it on a musical level.
Agreed.
From the gimmick.
I agree. And that's what we're talking about. The gimmick of Y&T. Obviously, it was yesterday and today when they started. Change it to Y&T. Doesn't make sense. I don't know what it means.
I see
a picture of the band. And this is made a big deal. You'll understand this. They weren't all that hot, for lack of a better term. There was nothing really sexy about Y&T. You know, because when you're growing up, like, obviously I'm not attracted to Bon Jovi, but you look at the guy and go, man, this guy picks up chicks. I want to be like that guy, you know, or David Lee Roth. Like, that guy, he's kicking and he's sexy and he's funny. You never got that with the Y&T guys.
Well, and you would, just from the music, I don't know what you lean towards as far as their music goes, but along those lines, like when you look at AC/DC, theirs was four guys that weren't that good looking, but you didn't expect them to be good looking because they're playing this badass, kick-ass rock and roll. The same with Skinner. I mean,
yeah,
like maybe one good looking dude, but everybody else, I mean, and I don't mean this as a knock. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just talking straight up, but
it was a different style.
Skinner was a badass band.
Absolutely, but different type of vibe. Once again, you're talking about a southern rock band. They're not. Like, Y&T is in the gene pool competing with Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, you know, whoever else was hot at the time. Lynyrd Skynyrd's southern rock. They should look like they're from Florida, from the bayou. You know, AC/DC had the biggest gimmick of all time, Angus Young.
Yeah.
And then throwing Brian Johnson with the hat, that's two gimmicks for the price of one.
Right.
So there's something about them you can latch on to. And I've found that over the years is that you always have, and especially a band like Y&T, once again, it's hard to be a great front man when you have a guitar. Now, Paul Stanley is the best at it. James Hetfield's right behind him. But you got to be a huge personality to be a front man and play guitar at the same time. And that's another thing that hurts that band, too.
Okay, then. Okay. And duly noted, what about a front man without an instrument?
Best front man?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh. You have to go with David Lee Roth. Freddie Mercury.
Okay.
I'll throw Bruce Dickinson in there from Iron Maiden.
Yep.
Those are kind of the three that
you had to put Freddie Mercury
in
there, because I was going to
say. Absolutely.
He's got to be either one or two.
Absolutely.
You know, David Lee Roth, his rap wasn't that great, but he was just, he fit the part.
He had that vibe.
And all the stuff that he got from, you know, because he got his routine from, who's the guy that there was a southern, kind of a southern rock?
Oh, it's Jim Dandy.
Jim Dandy.
Yeah.
And he kind of stole his gimmick, right?
Yeah. He kind of the same vibe. But Roth was almost like a stoner. He was like Spicoli in Fast Times, in that his rap wasn't great, but just the way he delivered it, you know?
Well, one of the things about that guy was that when he was doing interviews, he was so out there and so, you know, Jesus Christ. I mean, he's articulate in his own way, but highly intelligent. He can ramble and he can get out there. He's full of himself, but God dang, is he interesting?
And that's one. I know you didn't like the episode, but I loved your episode with Roth because he was just being Roth. And I know that you were trying to ask him certain questions, but like, I enjoyed it because I got Steve Austin talking to Dave Lee Roth, two very iconic characters in their different worlds colliding. I thought it was great.
But you know what? As you know from doing all your podcasts, as long as you've been doing it, over 400 episodes, it's so much better when you're talking to someone in person.
Was that on the phone with him?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
And this is way back in the day when this was in a glass studio where you could see everybody. Like, if this room was glass, you could see everybody else working in a different cubicles.
Right.
There's no atmosphere. There's no vibe. I think he's in New York City at the time. I'm in L.A.
It's hard.
I got all these notes. I mean, I didn't even know my producer. I was green. It was one of those type of things.
It's hard to do a podcast over the phone.
As a front man, I got to throw, I'm not, as an all-time great, no, but someone that I have to put in there is Ian Astbury.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Interesting. Interesting.
You know, I mean, the Cult.
Yeah. I mean,
did you ever get into them?
I loved the Cult. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite albums of all time is Cult Electric. Came out in 1987, and it was like at the right time of year. I think it came out in May, and that whole summer we just spent it at the beach. That was kind of the soundtrack to the summer. I never saw the Cult as being a great live band, though. The times I saw them, Asbury was cool, but he wanted to be more Jim Morrison. He wanted to be mysterious, you know? Great singer, yeah. Great list of tunes, but as a band, they never grabbed me as being super exciting.
And I get that, but for me, from not being a concert guy, I think I've been to, I don't know, 10 concerts in my entire life. Oh, dude, my first concert was Axe in Heaven. Probably before your time, and they were opening for Motley Crue.
Wow.
And I know we're going to do a podcast together. We're going to talk about music.
Right.
But when I was growing up, my dad was in a country and western band. He played lead guitar, mm-hmm. and he sang. So, dude, I couldn't sing even mm-hmm. then. So I was going to be a lead guitarist, mm-hmm. you know, but I didn't apply myself. And he's my stepdad, technically, so yeah. I get his musical genetics.
Right.
Tried the bass, no. They weren't buying me a drum kit, you know, so that didn't happen. But anyway, I was really into the rock and roll stuff and old country. My brother Kevin, who's 10 months younger than me, this is when Motley Crue first came out with Shout at the Devil. And he goes, hey, man, check this out. And I was like, I went into the crew because I never heard of them, but this is before I went to the concert, obviously. And I looked at the cover. I said, man, pretty good looking chicks in a manly kind of way. I didn't know that they was guys.
I remember looking at Vince Neil on that cover and going, how can that chick be so flat chested and how can they let her be on the front cover with no shirt on? Because he looked like the hottest chick, but his chest is hanging up, but there's no boobs, you know?
I mean, Motley Crue going to be, you know, one of my favorite bands of all time. Yeah. I can put them up there and, you know, they had a great run.
Right.
But anyway, hey, let's shift gears and make a segue into a little bit of wrestling. You just come off a high-profile match with Kenny Omega. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. I watched it.
Oh,
outstanding
thanks, man.
Match. But by the same token, I had to get back and watch some of your stuff from WWE. Now, here's the deal. You've been doing a podcast forever. I've been doing from a little bit over than forever, 500 episodes. Man, I didn't want to jump on Wikipedia and research your ass. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long we've known each other, man. Mm-hmm.
20 years.
When did you roll into WWE? Was it 98 or 99?
99. Okay. I met you a couple times before that on the plane one time, and you gave me the all-time greatest line of all time.
Was that dick?
You know, you said, oh, no, it was a great line. I was walking on the plane. It was one of those rare moments when you would see WWE and WCW on the same plane. And you walked by me and you said, hey. And I just knew Steve Austin. He's like, hey. He goes, you know, there's a gay guy in the plane. I said, really? He goes, yeah. Give me a kiss and I'll tell you I'll tell you who it is.
He goes, you know, you said, who is it? I said, kiss me, I'll tell you.
That's right,
You can't blow the punchline on that. Yeah, no pun intended.
That was your line. I just remember, like, Steve Austin just told me a joke. And then I saw you again at Brian Pillman's memorial show in Norwood, Ohio.
Yeah.
I was working with Benoit, and you were there to give your support as well. So that was about 98. So that's technically when I met you. Was
God
that time
dang.
Frame.
Man, I remember seeing you coming up when you first showed up in WCW. I said, man, he's a good-looking kid, long tights, his long hair pulled back in a little gimmick, ponytail or whatever you call it. I was like, man, this motherfucker, he's talented. I can see you coming. You can feel the charisma coming through the TV screen. I was like, this kid's pretty good. Mm. Then you came to New York, and I guess when you made your debut, when you interrupted DeRock's promo, shit, was I even in the building, or had I taken my ball and went home at that point?
No, you were there.
Okay.
You were there.
Dude, that was an awesome debut. Whose idea was the whole Y2J thing? Was that in collaboration with anybody?
No.
Are you going to Gene Simmons me on this? Everything was you. How'd it go down, brother?
I invented air, Steve. I'll tell you that right now. What happened was, it was at the time, because people ask me now, kids ask me, what does Y2J mean? I'm going to go ask your parents. So at the time frame, 1999, you know, as everyone who's our age knows, there was supposed to be a giant computer bug called the Y2K virus that was going to shut down the entire infrastructure, computers, the whole, you know, don't fly a plane because it's going to drop out of the sky. I remember I had $5,000 cash and a box of, I had this protein drinks at the time with Tang, and I was going to live off the $5,000 cash, and I had my, you know, liquid meals with me so I could survive when the riot happened. And nothing happened.
Right.
So, but still, everything was Y2K, 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 and I just thought, Y2J. I'm going to the WWE, obviously Jericho for J.
Yep.
I thought that's a great name for my finish. I'll call it the Y2J or the Y2J problem or whatever it may be. And I was at the mail house, the post office. I used to have a self-addressed stamp envelope to sign pictures. I wasn't doing call on WCW, so I was at least trying to start a rapport with the fans. Early days of the internet, send me your self-addressed, I'll send you the thing back. So I was waiting in line at the post office, and it said, like, you know, 122 days, 7 hours, 4 minutes, and 3 seconds until the new millennium. And I thought, wow, counting down. What a cool idea. Count down to the new millennium. That would be a cool way for someone to come into the WWE. Wait, that'd be a cool way for me to come into the WWE. So I came up with the idea of the Millennium Man with the countdown. Vince's contributions to it were that the countdown, my idea was it would end at the beginning of Raw. I think it was August 9th, 1999. Vince's idea was it would end right in the middle of The Rock's promo, which, classic Vince, you know, come in as high as you can possibly get. And his other idea was, he's like, well, what's your finish called and what is it? And I said, well, it's, you know, it's a Boston Crab and it's called Y2J problem. And he goes, no, that's not the name of your finish. He goes, your finish isn't Y2J, you're Y2J. And that was his, you know, moniker. And for the first year or two, I'm sure you got this too, it was never Chris or Chris Jericho. It was always Y2J. How are you, Y2J? Good to see you, Y2J. Because that was his creation. Even though it was my idea, he took it and that's what he called me. I'm sure it's the same with Stone Cold. I'm sure he called you Stone Cold all the time. I remember we always had to reference you as Stone Cold Steve Austin. I could say it 4 or 5 times, but I was, because Stone Cold Steve Austin, let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to come down the ring, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and I'm going to beat you up Stone Cold, because that's the name.
Right.
Not Steve, not Austin, right. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
And Steve almost humanizes me, and we didn't want to humanize
me. You are now a brand.
Right.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, Y2J. And that's kind of where it all started, you know, and I think you'll appreciate this. And I'm not sure if I've ever told you this before, but when I came into the company, I was a really popular babyface eventually. Started as a heel, turned babyface. If you look at all the beach towels and 7-Eleven cups at the time, there's always three guys on it, you, me, and Rock. And I started realizing that, like, I'm the George Harrison of the Attitude Era. I'm super popular, I'm super over, but I'm in a band with the two most popular over characters possibly ever. It doesn't matter what George does, he's never going to top Lennon and McCartney, right?
Yeah.
No matter what I do as a babyface, I'll never top Rock and Austin. So what can I do? I'll turn heel. And that's where that whole started, pitching to turn heel on you and on Rock to start working with you guys, because I knew I could never get past you guys or higher than you guys. You guys need someone to work with that can hold the microphone and go toe-to-toe with you. Because it wasn't easy to go toe-to-toe with you. It wasn't easy to go toe-to-toe with Rock. You guys were so good and had the crowd in the palm of your hand. You needed a good heel to be able to work with.
Oh, absolutely.
That could talk
and
could go on the mic with you as well.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I think we had some really good times with that.
Out of all your times in the business, Jesus Christ, how long have you been in the ring now?
27 years.
27 years.
October 2nd, 1990 was my debut. Yeah.
Heel or baby?
To give you the wishy-washy answer, honestly, heel. I've been a world champ 6 times, all of them as a heel. Never won it as a baby face. I think a lot of that's because of the George Harrison thing. But to me, I think it's a very rare character in the business that can portray a heel and a baby face at the same level. You know, you look at like Flair. When Flair was, he could never really play a baby face as good as he could as a heel. Same with Hulk. Hogan, he was okay heel, but as a baby face, it's Hulk. So, right?
Worldwide.
So to do both is a very hard skill, and I take great pride in the fact that I can do both. I prefer heel, but I always say it's a lot easier to make somebody hate you than it is to make them like you. But once they start hating you, it's hard to keep them hating you. It's like the greatest heels of all time in movies. Darth Vader, Terminator, Hannibal Lecter, the Joker. All of those characters, Freddy Krueger. As the movies went on, they became the baby faces. I used to go to Nightmare on Elm Street just to watch Freddy Krueger kill the kids. He wasn't scary anymore. He was cool.
Yeah,
that's what happens. Terminator 2, Arnold's the baby face at this point. Because he's so good as a heel, you start liking him. That's the true key of wrestling. If you can be a heel and stay a heel, it's very hard to do.
What was your relationship like with Vince when you first came to the company? Y'all started talking about the Y2J thing and how that morphed into your communication process with him. Because I'd been with Vince several times, and I've told this story many times. I apologize to my listeners for making me tell it again or making you listen to it again. Sit in a Jeep. One time, we was going to do a gig, throw a belt off a bridge or do something, one of those shenanigans. At the time, Vince drove a Jeep Grand Cherokee. I'm riding shotgun. He's driving. We're at a gate. It's locked with the chain. No one's there to unlock the chain so we can go do the gig. And so we're just sitting there with our thumbs up our ass. It's weird.
You know, because we don't know each other, man. You know, I just turned from Ringmaster and the Stone Cold. Right. And I'm starting to get a little momentum. And he's personally, and we're in his car to do this gig. Just out of the blue, he looks over at me. Dude, out of the blue. And he says, you know, Steve, as a promoter, you never want a talent to know what they're worth. Yeah, I was like, what do you say?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say nothing. I just sat there like it. Man, that was weird. Mm-hmm. He's a third-generation promoter, one of the smartest guys mm-hmm. walking planet Earth. About 2 minutes later, he fires up the Jeep, runs through the gate, and we go do the gig. Just blast it straight up, shoot, blast the chain off. And so, like, man, that right there forever opened my eyes and my brain to, okay, here's what's up.
Yeah.
And then one time we're in the garden again, and you know from working MSG, we're about to go do Monday Night Raw, and they're at the Barclays Center and the Manhattan Center. I don't know where I'm going to be. Whatever's going to happen, it happens. But an MSG, that's a short entrance. And there's that blue curtain. Like you said, when Vince is there, he's watched that curtain, or maybe he's prowling around at the top. We don't know he's there. One time we was watching those matches go down, watching everybody go to the ring. I was probably working in Maine. And sold out house. Steve Blackman goes to the ring, gets a hell of a pop, pretty good pop. You know, and he was on his way. You know, Steve Blackman had really good worker,
mm-hmm.
Really good physique.
Believable,
just solid.
Mm-hmm.
But he's never hit that next level. And boy, he got a pretty good pop. And I looked over at Vince and said, damn, pretty good pop. And Vince goes, yep, I really hope he can get over. And I'm like, there it is again. You know, Vince doesn't just wave a little wand over there and hit you with that pixie dust, that magic dust, and all of a sudden somebody's over. So how was your – meaning well, you, Vince don't just come at somebody. Or just take Roman Reigns, for instance. I mean, they're like, just point at a guy and say, you're over.
Mm-hmm.
It does not happen like that. So going back to – man, I don't go back in history. Just let's start off with the old man, then I want to peel it back a little bit to go through WCW and your territory days. Because one of the things I've always respected about you, I caught you in ECW. I didn't see you when you was in Mexico or when you was up in Canada or all those other places.
Mm-hmm.
You got over in ECW. You got over in WCW. You got over in mm-hmm. WWF. Mm-hmm. You got over everywhere you went.
Well, that's – and I'll answer your question about Vince, but that's one of the reasons why I was able to get over in WWE, because – I'm not sure if you went through it. I think you did. Obviously, you did with the Ringmaster. When we came from this other territory, other company, it doesn't matter what you've done anywhere else in the world until you go through the WWE curtain and Vince can see you. He doesn't care if you're Steve Austin, Triple H, Mick Foley, Chris Benoit, AJ Styles, or Chris Jericho. I would say he probably doesn't watch any wrestling whatsoever. He might hear some names. I don't think he cares. Your job when you get to the WWE is to basically start from scratch and show Vince what you can do. And if you can get over with him, you'll get a chance to get over. Not the pixie dust, but you need to get over with Vince first to get the chance to really get over, if that makes sense. So with Vince, actually a wise man, a bald guy with a goatee who's sitting across from right now, you said to me, you know, you really have to establish a relationship with Vince. It's so important. You told me that. And I've told a lot of guys that now. You have to get over this. Vince is very intimidating. And he's very scary, like waiting outside his office. You feel like you have to wait to go into the principal. Even to this day, I'm nervous to go in his office. But you have to establish that relationship with him so you can break that wall down of Vince McMahon, the boss, and Chris Jericho, the employee, and then two guys who are working together to create a good product. And then if you're really lucky, like Vince, I consider him to be a friend of mine now. I asked him to go to AC/DC with me last year when they were at the Garden with Axl Rose, and then he ended up tearing his quad, and he never said he would go, but I invited him. And I'm like, what if he wants to go? Like, what am I going to do? Like, do I stand in the seats with Vince and like air guitar with him? Like, what are we going to do if he shows up? Like, are these seats going to be good enough for him? Do I have to get a box now? Like, what do I do? Like, how is he as a guy? But there's a couple times over the years, and it took me a long time to really get to that relationship. I would say that it took me till 2008, 8 years of working for Vince until I lived up to the potential that I think he saw in me, but I never really delivered it to that level. Then I created that kind of hypocrite suit and tie, very slow talking character, worked with Sean. We had this amazing chemistry. Obviously, Sean, as you know, the best baby face a heel could ever work with.
Yeah.
And we were perfect match. Great baby face, great heel, great chemistry in the ring and out. And we had this whole big long 7 month angle. And that's when I think Vince saw me as a legit top guy that you can put the rocket to. And I was world champion 4 times during that run. And ever since then, we became closer and closer from that.
What did you learn? I was watching. God dang, is it Bruce Hart?
Mm-hmm.
Bruce still with us?
Yeah, Bruce is still alive.
Okay,
yeah.
Bruce, it might have been a Bruce interview talking to the dude from Northwest Wrestling, Hannibal. Now you started over, right? How long were you in that Calgary area?
A long time, man. Like I trained there with the Hart brothers, even though there was no Hart brothers at camp. Thank right. God Lance Storm was there. Cause first,
and y'all met from day one.
Day one. It's like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles when John Candy, when the train breaks down, he's got that big giant trunk and he's trying to carry it across the plane and then Steve picks up the one side. That's exactly what happened. I had this big trunk and we were living in a hotel called the Willingdon in Okotoks, Alberta, which is about 30 minutes outside of Calgary. And I had to climb the stairs to get to my room and I had this big trunk with all my worldly possessions and Lance, hey, are you here for wrestling school? Yeah, yeah. My name's Lance. My name's Chris. You need a hand? Sure. Picked up the one side of my trunk, and that's how I got it upstairs. So day one, first day I showed up, was him. With him.
So how long were you there?
I lived in Calgary till about 94. So I was working on and off. But also, I've been working full-time since 92.
Okay.
Mexico was full-time. Then it was Japan got full-time, Smoky Mountain. But I still lived in Calgary until 94.
Some time in Germany as well, right?
I did. I went there in 93 for 6 weeks.
Okay, my question to you, as you're making those rounds, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about the communication process in Mexico, because I'm not imagining you speak Spanish.
I learned.
Okay.
Yeah.
Smart guy.
Yeah.
What about your early years taught you how to get over? Because, dude, you're 27 years in now.
Yeah.
When I talk about getting over, I always like to talk about it with people who got over, because I still think it's a lost art.
Yeah.
I always like to hear how anybody else vocalizes or intellectualizes
sure.
it.
To finish up the point that we were making before is that I got over in WWE. It was very hard when I first came in because there was a lot of There was a target on my back because there was still the wrestling war was real. WCW and WWE.
Dude, that was a fierce dressing room.
It was.
And when you came in, I mean, I don't know how you felt, but I mean, I saw you. I saw talent. I said, man, this dude's got, you know, he can talk and he can work. I said, you know, I'm on my game.
Yeah, yeah. But I also came in as a WCW guy, you know, by myself. I didn't come in with Dean and Eddie and Chris and those guys. I didn't come in. Big Show came in by himself as well, but he's a giant. It's hard to,
different.
You know, I'm, you know, 5'11", 220 pounds and long blonde hair. There's other guys in the company that have long blonde hair that probably didn't like that aspect of it. And also, too, I came in with not a bad attitude, but I came in with some attitude. I wasn't afraid to.
Was it an attitude or a chip on your shoulder?
It turned into a big chip. At the time, I just came in as a heel. So I had no problem. I didn't know that you weren't supposed to talk shit about The Undertaker in a promo or talk bad about Steve Austin in a promo. That's what heels do to baby faces, right? But I learned very quickly that's not what heels do when they first come in. I had no idea. Nobody ever taught me anything about that in WCW. They didn't even tell me how to bump and feed a comeback. I worked WCW 3 years and had no idea what that even meant, as crazy as it sounds right now. Long story short, I eventually got over because I'd been over everywhere I'd ever been to for one reason and one reason only. I knew how to connect with the fans. If you can connect with an audience, whether you make them love you or hate you, you'll always have a job and you'll sell tickets and you'll become valuable. If you can connect with the audience, they'll be excited to see what you do. And the other thing I did in WWE was I knew, okay, I can't win with, like, you know, Hunter and DX. And, you know, Rocky was always cool and you were in and out and you were onto your own, but you were always cool to me. But what I did was I worked really hard always, but I knew if I could get over with the bullpen, with the mid-level guys, that would bleed up to the top. Bob Holly, you know, those type of guys, JBL, Bradshaw at the time, you know, working with those type of Rikishi, having great matches night after night with those guys, which is where I was programmed. The word gets around, you know, this guy is not an asshole. You guys are talking shit about him, but he's really good and he's a good guy. That kind of helped to alleviate some of the tension that was there. So that's basically how I got over. I believed in myself. And I connected with the audience.
Then how do you establish or communicate to an individual, one of the boys or gals listening? How do you connect with the people?
I don't know. It's almost like saying, like, how do you sing like Paul Stanley, or how do you get over like Steve Austin? How do you throw a football like, you know, I don't even know anything about Brett Favre or whoever's a good quarterback. I don't really know. I think it's something that you have inside of you. It's that charisma, fearlessness. You can't be afraid to, oh, something you can relate to. You can't be afraid to be Stone Cold Steve Austin and put on a little cowboy hat and sing Kumbaya on a freaking ukulele out of tune and horrible. Like, that was you committing to the character. I committed to the character every time. As a heel, as a baby face, anything I could do to you know, never ever again, for example, start in WCW when I ripped Dave Penzer's tuxedo off, and the next week they made me go back in there with a tuxedo, and I said, I promise I will never, ever, like, just over the top, like, I got it from Sally Field. You like me. You really like me. And it's like, I don't like you anymore from that, so I'll never, ever do it again. And then you see people with signs.
Right.
And Jimmy Hart taught me. He said, Jimmy was great, man. I love, love, love Jimmy Hart, but he told me, he said, you can't make people write signs. I mean, you know, you can plant them, but these weren't planted. You can't force somebody to write Austin 316 or never, ever again with 14 pieces of cardboard with one E, one E, one E, one V. You can't. This is buddies. Hey, dude, let's take an ever sign. And that's how you know you're starting to connect.
That's like the ultimate compliment.
It is. And so you have to be
connecting.
Exactly. You have to be fearless. Just like you with Austin 316. You took a chance. It might have stuck. It might not have. If that not have stuck, something else would have. And I always laugh because I have so many kind of, let's say, hits for catchphrases. If I was in a rock and roll band, well, I am. But, you know, like a hit with Ayatollah of Rock and Roll, a hit with Roz Jericho. But there's been some misses. I remember that I thought Razzle Dazzle. That's going to be huge. That'll be the next catchphrase. I'm going to get a little razzle dazzle,
yeah.
Razzle dazzle, and then just die to death. And the other one was get it, got it, good. And I would say get it, and the crowd would say got it, and then I would say good. It just, I tried it a couple times. It sucked. It stunk. You had one. Do you remember? I'll tell you one that you had.
What? Which one was it?
I'm going to put a little stink on it.
What?
I'm going to put a little stink on it.
Oh, you know.
You went through the phase. That would be your thing you would say every time. Before what? I'm going to put a little stink on it. I'm going to put a little stink on it. And just kind of like.
Man, when you throw out a turd.
It humbles you.
It's just sinking feelings like, God damn, I can't let them see me. I'm not going to let them see me sweat. But inside, I know this shit ain't working. But you got to try.
But you got to try. And that's the thing. Like, you got to be fearless. The saying is like, the only failure is not trying. But a lot of people in the business are afraid to try. And also at this point in time, aren't given the option to try. And that to me, like when I thought of the idea of the highlight reel, my initial idea was learning from one of the greatest, I don't even know what you would call him, backstage interviews is Gene Okerlund,
right,
who could lead you through a backstage promo, even if you didn't know what you were doing, right?
Yeah.
That's how I learned to do promos. I used to go sit in the box. WCW had a box where you would do localized promos. We're coming to Jacksonville. We're coming to, you know, the Odessa, whatever. And I would just sit in there because you're sitting around all day. There's nothing to do. I'll go watch guys do promos. And I watch Arn Anderson and Ric Flair and, you know, the Mountie or Glacier, whoever's there getting promos. And then maybe one day they'll ask me. And one day Luger didn't show up because he wanted to go to the gym. So we go, what about that guy? He's always sitting in the corner. You want to do a promo? Sure. And I remember it was for where's the Van Andel Arena? I think it's Kalamazoo. No, Wings calls him. No, it's Grand Rapids or something. One of those Michigan cities. And I had to do a promo. It was rotten. But Gene Okerlund was the guy who was doing the interview and led me through it. And then the next week they gave me two, and then they gave me three, and gave me four. That's how I learned how to promo. No script, just on your own instincts. And my idea when I started the Hyler was I wanted to be the Gene Okerlund, have guys come out that didn't get promo time and let me do an improv promo. Let's see what they got. That, of course, did not fly with Vince. He wanted it to be an actual promo segment with top-level guys. But my idea was I wanted to see what can people do when they're not being scripted and they don't have handcuffs, you know? I still think they should do that this day at every show. You know, in between main event and Raw, there's a 10-minute period. Send somebody out there. You got 3 minutes, and you don't tell anybody who it is during the day. You just be like, Xavier Woods, go out there for 3 minutes. What am I supposed to talk about? I don't know. And see what they got. And Woods would kill it, but give somebody else, right, like Heath Slater or Curt Hawkins or whoever. You would see then who can do a promo and who can connect with the audience. You would get it right like that.
Question before I go, between today's locker room versus that Attitude Era locker room, mm-hmm, or when you came in 99.
It was Attitude Era, yeah.
So one of my big pet peeves is when the announcer backstage, whoever it is, whether it's male or females, talking to the talent, ask talent a question. Talent gives the answer. If there's an interrupt, there's an interrupt, but talent gives the answer. And it's an awkward feeling. And then all of a sudden, it's back to Michael and the guys at the desk. And the camera stays on the interviewer who's got this awkward answer. There's been some intended, you want there to be some heat there. And all of a sudden, it's just an awkward reaction to the person that's part of the broadcast team. It'd be like Aaron Andrews not throwing back to the guys calling the game. What are your thoughts on that? Because I think she should, I think whether it's a male or female, they should throw back to the announce team, because I don't think the heat, the point, or anything goes anywhere, because I'm so focused on that weird look that the interviewer has on their face.
And you can't look at the camera, so you're kind of just staring off into the distance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it.
Well, I mean, and you know, I don't have to tell you this, and it's, you know, Pat Patterson said it best. It's like, you know, it's Vince's ice cream shop, and sometimes he likes chocolate, and sometimes he likes vanilla, and sometimes he likes neither one. It's his ice cream store. That's the way Vince wants it. In Vince's mind, that's how he wants it. So you have to work within those parameters. Do I think it's good? Not necessarily. I think the backstage interviewers now, could they be, and I say this respectfully because I know they're just doing what they're told, could they be more robotic? I loved that. I know it's 80s wrestling, as Vince would say, but the Gene Okerlund and Lee Marshall as well, who's passed away since, they were great. They were great at it because they would have some energy, and like Gene would be like, oh, what are you talking about? You can't talk to me like right. that, Bobby Heenan. Oh my God. Let's. And they would throw back.
Right.
It. There's a lack of energy sometimes to the show when you don't let people be themselves. Like, I'm a ham. You're a ham. I will Cena eat you worse than William Shatner if you let me. But even if you don't, there's still a way to captivate, even as right. that quiet talking heels. If I talk quiet, everyone has to shut up and listen to me. I remember sometimes I'd do promos like that, and people in the crowd would be like, we can't hear you. And then I'd go even quieter. Then you better fucking listen, man. And that's like one person captivating a whole arena of people. I find sometimes that guys aren't given the opportunity to take that ball and run with it because it's very regimented.
The regimentation.
Yeah.
Or the, I don't know, I just feel like there's a kind of, everybody's walking on eggshells these days just because there's nowhere else to go. And everybody's just micromanaged to a degree. And I'm not indicting the system. Hell, I'm going to be up there on Monday Night Raw for the 25th anniversary. But it's just one of those things that just kind of, man, from back in the day, you know, when I came in as a ringmaster, and I knew it was a suck-ass gimmick, right? But, hell, I had a wife, two kids, you know, log cabin on 10 acres. Shit, I got to pay my bills. They're going to take all my shit from me.
Right.
So I go up there. I'd already went to visit Vince twice. I knew they didn't have anything planned for me. I needed to bring me in as a mechanic. So, shit, I never came. Then finally, after I busted my arm, went to ECW, got under the learning tree of Paul Heyman. You know, I said, okay, it's time to go. You know, Vince said, oh, goddamn, pal, we'll bring you in. $1 million champion. Ted DiBiase is your manager. And I love Ted DiBiase, right?
Of course.
So anyway, so I came up. I knew that wasn't going to work after 6 months. And so that's when, you know, well, whatever. Started thinking about it and, you know, drinking beer, you know, whiskey, whatever it was, watching, you know, television. Came up with the, you know, the Stone Cold persona. Anyway, whoever came up with it came up with it. And that was my name. And when I went out there and, you know, I remember Scott Hall came up to me and he goes, because all of a sudden it was on the backstage. Remember, they used to have boards there, so-and-so versus so-and-so.
They still do. Yeah,
they still do. So, you know, Razor Scott sees that now I'm called Stone Cold Steve Austin. He goes, Stone Cold, yeah? What's that all about? And I was like, yeah, I didn't really have a definition of the gimmick yet. But I had a sense of where it was going to go and what I could do with it. I said, oh, man, I said, just give it time. I'm telling you, yeah, it'll work. Just watch. So, anyway, I always went out there, dude, and, you know, when I guess Russo was doing the book and he was on my show the other day, he says, you know, he had, you know, created the opportunity for me to go ringside and do some color commentary. I went out there and did it, and, you know, that's when I noticed that they were, you know, they weren't, this is when we're going live tape.
Yeah.
They started editing all my shit, and I talked with Vince. I said, hey, man, why are you editing my stuff? And he goes, well, quite frankly, Steve, you're popping the guys in a truck, you know, and he wanted me to be a heel. But so, anyway, I told him right then and there, I said, dude, I'm 6'1", 250, bald head goatee, you know, 6'10", 7 feet guys, 300, 320. I'm speaking fast because everybody's heard my story so many times. I said, if you give me my personality, I said, I can, you know, I can compete. If you take my personality from me, I can't compete. Okay, I've said that story a million times. I just told you. My point is, dude, back in the day, because there's still WCW, there was still, you know, ECW. Hell, I wasn't making no money. I was making, you know, the little bit of money one night a week working for Paul. So I didn't, what did I have to lose? So finally, every time I got a chance to go out there, I didn't give a shit. Mm-hmm. I was going to, go out on a limb, push the envelope, do whatever it took, because it didn't make a shit.
Right. It didn't matter.
All right, let's take a quick pause for the calls and give big ups to True Car. Hey, here's some useful car tips you might not be aware of. A coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior. Removing excess weight from your car will improve the gas mileage. Placing your key fob to your chin will increase its range. That's true. Ready for one more tip you might not know about? True Car also helps people get used cars. That's right. True Car ain't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with True Car, users can see what others paid, so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. They're also more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with True Car certified dealers. When you are ready to buy a new or used car, check out True Car and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. You're also going to need car insurance for that new vehicle. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
Many of you listening to this are in your car right now. But do you love your car? If not, we want to help. I'm Todd.
I'm Paul, and we host the Everyday Driver Car Debate podcast.
We help listeners just like you find cars that are fun to drive and still fit their budgets and their needs.
Along the way, we discuss car news, we tell stories from filming cars for our TV and web shows, and we also answer audience questions from you.
So join us every Tuesday and Friday for the Everyday Driver Car Debate.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
And it's funny because I just did this in Japan with the Alpha versus Omega
Loved
thing.
It.
Where, thank you, but the angle beforehand in Fukuoka a couple weeks before, then the press conference, then after the show I did another press conference.
Yep.
I didn't care. I was like, I'm not a big dude, but over there, I'm a big guy. And I was thinking, I want to be like Bruiser Brody and Stan. I want to scare these guys, like these reporters and shit. They don't deal with that nowadays, but there was no rules. I was swearing. I was, during the match, I grabbed the camera and took a picture of me flipping the bird to the crowd, took pictures of it. They put that in the magazine, which like I came across as this like lunatic who would do anything and didn't care, ripping up reporters' books and yelling at them and, throwing tables and threw a garbage can full of like cigarette butts in water on one of the reporters from Tokyo Sports. He got covered in like cigarette butt water. But I'm like, I don't care. I'm doing it. And everybody's flipping out Jericho, because there's no restrictions. And like you said, I didn't care. I might never come back here. I want to have some fun. I want people to know I'm different from any other foreign guy or any of the Japanese guy. I don't give a shit what the rules of Japan are. I don't care what we went to a press conference in this very nice hotel. Like, don't throw anything off. If the table costs $1,000, I'll pay for it. But you're going to sell tickets because of it. And it was really, what's the word I'm looking for? Gratifying and whatever there's a word for it. There was just this freedom after 17 years of having to have stuff approved by Vince or agents or whatever. I didn't have to have anything approved. I could do anything I wanted. And what a cool feeling that was.
As far as the match goes, and I saw the build-up stuff.
Liberating. That's what I was looking for. Sorry.
Liberating. But I don't know if you remember the conversation. I told you, I said, dude, to me, you just look free out there.
Yeah.
I said exactly that. And that's what came across to me. I said, this dude, he doesn't give a shit. He's not being held back. He can do anything he wants. He's not. That's
it. And like I said, there's not like, there's a kind of a misconception in WWE that you get held back. And it's not getting held back, but there's certain rules that we have to abide by because that's it's a corporate company now. There's no juice allowed, no chair shots. And thank goodness for that. I mean, I sent you that gif a couple months ago of you just wailing guys with chair shots. Did you think of how we used to do that? Mm-hmm. And you took them too. That was just part of the business. And to look back at that, it's so barbaric. It's like we're stabbing each other with maces or something. But there's certain things you just cannot do in the WWE.
Correct.
And to have the restrictions to do whatever you want, like, okay, I want to go through a table. Let's do it. Let's put up a chair. It's a no DQ match. That's why I wanted no DQ. Didn't want to bury the referee, even though everyone else does. I wouldn't feel good about that. So we had the permission to do it. Let's use it. and not having to get it approved was kind of a cool feeling.
But there being, you know, with the rule system being in place that is there now, there were rules back when I was running wild over there, right?
Yeah.
But you just push the envelope due to whatever the rule structure is.
Mm-hmm.
But just because, here's the thing, when you are limited, you know, physically or from a standpoint of picking up chairs, tables, this, that, whatever, dude, I mean, you've seen matches inside the squared circle where no one left the ring. And a summit just either goes haywire or goes off, or the baby's got so much fire, or that heel's such a piece of shit, or that mean streak, or whatever he's doing within, you know, I'm talking about today's system.
Yeah.
You can get over. I mean, it's all about, and I was just like someone asked me the day, you know, it was a whole different conversation, but I said, man, you got to be a fighter. And whether you're a heel or a baby, you got to be a fighter to get over. And I don't mean to segue out of it, but people say, could Stone Cold Steve Austin get over in today's WWE?
Absolutely.
Hell yeah, he could.
Absolutely.
Same rules, same guy.
That's something that, like, I know Batista said something at one point of, like, it would be hard to get over him in the PG-13 environment or something along those lines. Dave's a great guy, and I disagree with him because he could get over, because a good worker is a good worker. And I don't care if it's Attitude Era or PG-13 or ECW or Lucha Libre. If you know what you're doing, you can incorporate any style or any rule that needs to be done and still get over. It's easy if you're good. I had no problem switching from Attitude Era to PG-13-0. Stop saying son of a bitch. Stop saying jackass. You know, all that sort of stuff. And you know, it wasn't that hard because I know what I'm doing. It's not bad.
But it's also, it's delivery. And not everything is content. Not everything. You ain't got to go out there and recite a Rush, lyrics to get over.
Yeah.
And by the same token, in the structure of a match, you don't got to do a million moves and a bunch of whirligigs and flips and shit off the top turnbuckle to get over.
You don't. You know, and just to go back to what you're saying, and this is just something that I always have noticed. I don't think I've ever told. It's not really much of a story, but I remember I was in a tag team match one time with Undertaker, and he was on the apron side while we were getting heat on whoever we were getting heat on. And a couple of false tags, and he couldn't get in. And at one point, he jumped on the floor. He grabbed some water. He poured it over his head. He hit the damn steps like bam, 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 bam. He looked like he was going nuts. And I was like, people loved it. Because
who did that?
Undertaker.
Okay.
And why do you have to stand on the apron holding it? He was like, I'm a caged animal. I've got water and chaos and plunder around ringside. You knew he wanted this tag.
Right.
And everyone else would just stand there. Tag me. He was like, fuck it, I can't stand anymore. No. I'm going to go crazy. Hit the damn thing. And you know he's ready to go. You know, he's jumping up. And this is Undertaker showing like a Brian Pillman 1989 babyface fire.
Slapping the mat.
And I just always remembered that. And of course, I tried it a couple times. I was never as good at doing it as Taker was. But just little things like that shows that is a true professional. He knows what he's doing, and there's no gimmick, dead man, anything of that shit. It's just a guy who knows he's connecting with the audience. He's letting people know, I want this tag, and I'm going to get this tag, and you guys know I'm going to get it. And everyone's like, yeah, you're going to get it. And when he got the tag, you know, it blew the roof off, as you can expect. But it was just that little extra little bit. I learned this in Mexico from a guy called Negro Casas, who is one of the best wrestlers I've ever worked with, not in Mexico, anywhere. They call him the Ric Flair of Mexico. He understands the psychology of where he is. He's not a flipper or a flyer. He's just, his details taught me that the difference between a good worker and a great worker is the little things. Really is.
I agree.
And if you know how to do those little things, you will transcend from good to great. But it's amazing how many guys don't know the little things.
Well, that's why I was like, I was on YouTube the other day, and I was just looking at old random videos, and it was you, and this was so many years ago because Dallas Page was still living in Playa Vista, and that's where I used to live with him when I first came out to Los Angeles, and you guys had went through a yoga workout, and y'all were talking about Eddie Guerrero. And it was me and Eddie.
Yeah.
You know, you had that meeting with him where you first met him, and he was grouchy, but then
he was
next
drunk,
time, super nice Eddie. Anyway, the guy was phenomenal, but I don't mean to ramble. Eddie was one of those guys that if you knew anything about wrestling, you picked up on the little things he did. If you didn't know anything about wrestling from a technicality standpoint, just from watching him, for some reason it resonated with you at a deeper level because you were seeing a guy who was so detail-oriented. The little things meant so much. Mm-hmm. It's just something is even that little thing. If the baby face, let's say baby face is laying on his back face up, and there's just that little peel out on the damn face, you know, on the forehead.
Put his heel and crush out a cigarette butt on your forehead.
How many people do that? There's a couple that do it, ain't nobody does it like Eddie.
Does it where it looks like he's putting out a cigarette butt on your forehead
with the stink on it.
Yeah, with a little stink
and
on it.
But it's those little things that made Eddie so great.
Eddie was really, really good at that sort of stuff, and you know. Like I was thinking about this the other day, man. I missed Eddie. I wish he was still around because he was such a goofball, but like just a really good guy, obviously. But he really took everything very personally. And we talked earlier about back in the day when we were running, we were a little bit nuts. He never really went nuts. He took everything so personally. Like if the house was down like 200 people when he was a champion, he would be really legitimately sad. You know, if he heard one person booing him when he was supposed to be a babyface. Actually, you went through that phase too. I remember we had a match in El Paso, of all places. We tore the house down, and you were pissed off after. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "There was one guy on the front row. He's giving me the finger." I'm like, "Dude, there's 10,000 people chanting your name." But at the time, that bothered you. You couldn't get over it. Eddie was like that too. So involved and so into it that anything that he felt was a slight against him and his abilities, he would take it very, very personal. And that's why I think he eventually would have gotten over it, but I don't think the first time he was a champion, they didn't keep it on him long because I don't think he could take it. It's a lot of pressure to be the champion, and I think it kind of made him go a little bit crazy because of it, you know?
It seemed to me, as little as I knew Eddie, and I knew him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And
did you ever work with him?
Yeah, okay. I requested to work with him because I'd kind of been running hard, and I was kind of just getting caught up in... I want to work again. I don't want to rely on a gimmick, man. And, you know, Eddie was a worker. Mm-hmm. He's a worker's worker. And so I requested to work with him. And after about a week's worth of shows, they pulled us apart because they needed me to work with...
Whoever was on top or whatever.
Yeah, someone on top. But I requested to work with a guy. And met as many guys as we both know that have gone down. I'm not a big funeral guy. Mm-hmm. I went to Eddie's funeral.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember seeing you there.
I went there.
It surprised me because I remember you had talked about that before. Not being a funeral guy.
I want to get to a match with you and Shawn Michaels, but you mentioned earlier, I was thinking earlier about Brian Pillman when I was thinking about you as far as your freedom in that match against Kenny Omega. And didn't just say, "Oh, that's Brian Pillman." It resonated. Man, he's in the zone. Mm. He's really free. But then also just talking about Eddie Guerrero, it would be great if Brian was still around. And that guy was so far ahead of his time just from a gimmick standpoint. Remember back in the day, you know, when you would run with a guy and we were tagging and you're on the road with a guy for 3 weeks, you know, it's kind of like, okay, man, when I go home for these 2 days, I just want to chill out and not hear from anybody. Man, there's Brian calling me, kid, got a scoop. And it was always good to hear from him. So he's a guy that I wish was still around. I guess the thing I'm getting to, a lot of guys get lost on the road into a bunch of shit. I hung out with the drinking crowd. I kind of was the drinking crowd. If it wasn't nobody else, you know, that's just kind of what I did. How did you get away or stay away from just the gamut of pills that a lot of guys fall into? Because some of the guys that I've talked to, survivors like Del Wilkes, the Patriot, you know, guys that are telling me, man, I'm taking 40 to 60, you know, Oxycontins gimmicks, or Percocets or whatever. I'm like, I don't understand that. I don't know how you do it. I mean, because back in the day, dude, a couple of pots of coffee, two Vicks, I'm done. That's it. And I didn't take any pain pills if I was hurt. I mean, when I broke those bones in my back, I had a doctor, you know, shooting me up with Toradol before I went out there every night. My point is, I just didn't go down that road. I didn't get lost in it. How did you stay away from it, or did you not?
I don't really know the answer to that. I just know, like, when I grew up, you know, the 80s, I started wrestling in 90. This might sound really dumb, but whatever. At the time, it was really still say no to drugs. That was what was hammered into our heads when I was in high school, a teenager. Yep. Say no to drugs, don't do drugs, don't do drugs, don't do drugs. And some guys that I knew smoked a little weed and stuff, but I just never was interested. Don't do drugs. I don't want to do drugs. I don't know why would I want to do drugs. And I just never started with that. I never did any of the pills, even back in Calgary and Mexico. Guys that I would hang with would be doing all the pills. I just didn't. I don't know why. I still to this day, I've never done cocaine in my life. Never. I just never had the desire to, for whatever reason.
Dude, out of all your years in the music scene that you're involved in, touring with Fozzy,
never
worldwide,
once.
Wrestling, yeah. all the, dude,
yeah.
there was a couple of stops where there would be, you know, there would be the guy with the gimmicks.
I went through, I did shrooms and that sort
there's
of
no props
scene
to you,
and
dude.
That sort of thing,
yeah.
but I just never... For whatever reason, but I just liked having a drink, and the guys that I ran with just liked having a drink. I remember Raven will tell you this too. We used to have this gang that we called us the Drunken Four Horsemen, and it was me, Raven, Kurt Hennig, and Mongo McMichael. Now, I don't know if Mongo and Kurt knew that was the name, but it was always the four of us hanging out, and we were called the Drunken Four Horsemen. That's what me and Raven called each other. And there was never drugs with those guys. It was just drinking. Here's how you gargle Jack Hennig. Here's how you gargle Jack Daniels, kid, and fool people. You let it dribble out the side of your mouth and let some other sad sack gargle Jack Daniels, which will kill you. Anybody that's listening, it will kill you. Like, it will get you super drunk. And McMichael, I remember he broke his arm one time, and he drank a bottle of Jack and started hitting his broken arm. Listen to this. Hitting his arm on the damn table. Like, what are you doing? Oh, it doesn't hurt. Those were the guys that I had fun with. So it was never a pill atmosphere. For whatever reason. And then when I got to the point where I didn't have to worry about peer pressure or anything, I just made the decision. I'm not going to bother. I'm not gonna, even ECW. Nobody ever approached me to do it. You know, I don't know. It just never kind of came my way. I remember just to finish off, when I did break my arm in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, I broke it earlier in the day trying a shooting star press because somebody, Ultimo Dragon, convinced me I could do one. And of course, I had no idea what I was doing. Tried one earlier in the day, broke my arm, went to the hospital, came back. We had a big show. It was the semi-main event of this sold-out thing that Cornette had. It was me and Lance against the Heavenly Bodies, Jimmy Del Rey and Dr. Tom. I worked the match with a broken arm. Dr. Tom, they were taking one-arm body slams from me. Those guys were so good to do that for me. But I remember they gave me some pills, whatever the pain pills were for having a broken arm, and I didn't take them. I remember Brian Lee was really concerned. Are you okay, man? Are you all right? Did you get any pain pills? Yeah, here, take them. So I had a broken arm and never took pain pills. Who does that? A plate in my arm. You can still see the scar to this day. Just decided I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to fall down that path. So, and here I am.
That's good for you.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, because there was a lot of shit going on back in the day, and we had our stops. It was a good time. One last Kurt Hennig story. The thing with Kurt was when he was in WWF or when we were in WCW or vice versa, whichever one, for some reason, you know, Kurt was a legend.
Yeah.
A living legend. Among the boys, he was just beloved because he's always in a good mood.
Yeah.
He's always up
always
to hijinks.
Smiling,
he was a world-class worker, highly charismatic, a ton of fun. If he was having a bad day, I don't think anybody would ever know.
Yeah.
But when you cross paths with Kurt, you had to do a shot of Jack with him, and you had to gargle it. That was the rule.
So,
I'd be, you know, like it happened to me twice. I'm walking through an airport, man, I got my sunglasses on. I'm pretty haggard, and, you know, there's Kurt. You know, got to gargle a shot with him.
Come on, have a shot.
Yeah, that was the deal.
Yeah.
Hey, before we leave, because I know we want to do your podcast, I want to leave time for that. That match with Shawn Michaels, it got match of the year. It was a ladder match. It was in 2008. Was that WrestleMania? Or no, that
no
was,
it was
No Mercy.
No Mercy. It was in October of 2008.
Jesus Christ. I probably remember watching it back in. I don't know if I'd taken my ball and went home because I wasn't even on the card.
I don't think you were there at the time.
But Jesus Christ, I watched that match before you came over, before I scanned through some of your facts. But real quick, on a comparison, that match, Kenny Omega, obviously two different things. On your list of accomplishments,
well,
I know you're proud of the fact that you drew money in Japan. Buy rates, subscriptions, and all that with Omega.
Yeah. But that drew money too.
I just thought, you know, the way you. I listened to you earlier with Bully Ray. I was like, okay, I didn't know if you had a grudge or a chip or whatever.
No,
I was like, because this was that ladder match was so awesome.
Up until the Omega match. And it's still, I don't know, but if people ask what's your favorite match, I'd always say the ladder match with Sean. There's a lot of reasons for that. I think, A, this is being completely biased, but also just saying how I feel. It kills the Sean Razor ladder match. It blows it out of the water, but it wasn't as monumental because that was the first one. Another reason why I love it is because it was the culmination of a seven-month feud that was supposed to go one day. It started when Batista and Sean had a match. And I was the guest referee, and the idea was Sean would hurt his knee. I would wave off the match, and then we would find out later on that Sean was faking it. And I knew he was faking it, but he would claim that he wasn't. And then it would lead to a match that we would work each other. Sean would win in the end. But Sean is so good because the original idea was there'd be some kind of a finish and then we'd have a match. And then Sean was like, no, this is too, we can do something with this. We'd worked at WrestleMania 2003. You and Rock worked that night, in Seattle, and we had great chemistry. And he's like, this is a waste to do this and just pay it off with one show, one pay-per-view. And I remember we asked Vince, this is a classic Vince, question and answer. What do you want for the finish? And Vince goes, I don't know. I just booked the shit. You guys figure it out. All right, and then Sean came up with this idea where he tweaks his knee. I believe him. Am I the fool? Is he the fool? And we started this big, long angle that went through all these shapes and phases. And we had the first match was a real technical match. The second one was the match where Vince decided there was no more blading because he gigged so hard. You go back, he's bleeding everyone. After that, Vince says, no more blading. That was at the time when he was thinking about it. Done. And then we had then we were going to pay it off at SummerSlam. And Sean said, it's not good enough because we have this great chemistry. There was Edge and Taker, and there was Hunter and somebody. We're going to be third. You know, Sean will be third or fourth on the bill at best. I'm not going to waste that. Or whatever he said.
I love his attitude. When
great attitude, man. And then he had the idea, well, why don't I say I'm going to retire? Because I'd done something where I dropped Till holding him into the corner of a desk, and he sold that his eye was all messed up. And the thing is, his eye really started to go a little bit cross-eyed. People think it's because of that. Look at, you see Sean now. He's a little bit of a wonky eye.
Yeah.
People think it's from that angle. It's not. So he had the idea of bringing in his wife. And then he would say, everybody, I'm retiring. But I came down to spoil his retirement ceremony. I go to punch him. He zigs. I zag. I punch his wife in the face for real, by the way, which was awful. But she was okay, and then in hindsight, it made it real. Everybody in the building was like, listen, this wrestling stuff, I don't know, is it showbiz or not? If someone punched my old lady the way that, I would kill this guy. My aunt, my mom, my sister took a different. So anyways, long story short, we finally got to the ladder match for the world championship in the main event. This feud was never supposed to be for the title, but I got so hot off it, and Sean got so hot off it, it became a world title angle. And that's why I love that ladder match, because A, it was a great match, and B, the story to get there was one of the greatest angles in WWE history.
But how long had you had that title going into that feud? Was that the...
I won the title once again. It all tied in, and this is classic Vince booking. I punched Sean's wife in the face, then we have to do an unsanctioned match, which means whatever happens, the WWE is not held liable for any of this. And it was basically a street fight. That table bump I took in Alpha vs. Omega, I got from the Sean sanction, where he hits me with a chair. I fall off the corner through the table that I've set up earlier. And he beat the shit out of me. He killed me. And the finish was, he just beat me. He beat me up. He beat me to submission. They rang the bell. He came back, beat me up some more, beat me up some more, whipped me with the belt, hit me with this cowboy boot. I was beat the fuck up.
Right.
Then, guess what happens? The last match on the show is a scramble match, a five-way match. CM Punk gets beaten up. Who's the fifth guy? Me. I come in, get the shit kicked out of me by everybody, and it's one of these things where you could win the title, and whoever has it at the end, hot potato wins. And Batista is the champion, and he powerbombs Kane, and I roll Batista up, 1, 2, 3, bell hits 0, I'm the champion. So I walk out of there as a champion.
Okay, okay.
Even though Sean had beat the shit out of me. So that led us to the ladder match.
See, going into that, and I didn't know the whole build-up, but it was just an awesome match. And the thing I liked about the match was, it was so smart because you've seen. So, and first of all, the first ladder match between Razor and Sean or whoever else had one in a small territory.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, we're talking about WWF.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to Razor Sean match. And then the way you guys started this thing out, you started putting the work in, solid work, but it was just laid out in such an intelligent fashion. You were using the ladder as a weapon. You're using it as a means to an end to try to get to the belt. But you didn't do everything from the top of the ladder. And so I like the fact that it was so ground-based and using the scissor action, using pivot points, the spot, you know, in the corner, coming out of the figure four, which he reversed on you, and then you kicked the ladder into his face.
Yeah.
I mean, his sell job on that. Oh, you know, that one bump where you're climbing to the top and, you know, you pinned him. You pinned him. You're climbing to the top. And Jesus Christ, he's got to watch you ascend to the top of the ladder now and get this damn belt. You become the champion and he's helpless. You take a mega bump. And that was a masterful bump. I mean, you do things like that. And there are several other instances as well, great bumps that were done from a high angle and on top of the ladder. which are extremely high risk, and you guys both stayed safe. I don't know how you felt after the match. You can tell me. But I just like the scissor action, using it as a weapon. You know you need to climb it. But the Hardy Boys, Chris and Edge, Dudleys, you know, all those guys have unbelievable matches.
Yeah.
This was a match that would, out of all of, and they've all been, for the most part, they've all been spectacular. This was one of the best ever.
Well, I appreciate that. And actually, the idea of that was to not, you can't compete with the Hardys and Edge and Chris and those guys. Let's use the ladder as a weapon. It's something that actually, there's another great ladder match I had against Benoit, Royal Rumble in New Orleans, 2001. That's the first time I ever did the Walls of Jericho on the ladder. It's a famous moment. But our idea was, it's a ladder. Let's use it as a weapon. Let's not even climb this thing. Took the same concept with Sean. After all we've done, we need to just beat each other up with this ladder. And instead of thinking of ways to take bumps off it, let's look at ways to take bumps using it. And that's why it worked, because you have to think, this is a 7-month, this is a literal blood feud. Like, even at the unsanctioned match, even though he beat me, Sean was still crying at the end because he still couldn't erase the pain he went through from punching his wife. So you had to make it violent and real. Another thing about this is, dude, it hit me in the, I lost half a tooth.
I saw that.
And that's real. I mean, and that horrible thing to lose your teeth in the ring. But once again, I remember when it came on, I looked up and I smiled and I had half a tooth. And I remember I thought to myself, I look like the ghost of Benoit. It kind of freaked me out. But to see that, that made it real. And the next night on, I didn't go to the dentist the next day because I wanted to go on Raw the next night and show the world that I had lost half a tooth. I looked like Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber. And, you know, I want to show people this is what happened. Yes, I won, but this is the price I paid for real. This is not a gimmick wrestling thing. I lost half a freaking tooth that I still might lose at some point because they said it might rot and die because the root got messed up too. But that, to me, you have these happy accidents. You know, Alpha vs. Omega, I got my lips split, so I'm spitting blood. It just makes it that much more. It's the classic Austin Brett double turn. If you hadn't got the color on that hold when he had you in the sharpshooter, it wouldn't have been the same. No. And obviously, you did that getting color, but still, it needed it. The half the tooth, the whole thing, it made it a classic, classic match with all of the elements that happened in spite of the match and because of it.
I didn't know the finish of the match because, like I said, I remember watching it, but as we were talking before we hit the sound button, the record button, dude, I've forgotten so much shit, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that's just life, not
right.
No
sure,
steel
sure,
chair,
course,
nothing.
Of course, of course.
The finish of that match, I'm thinking, goddamn, it's where Sean's going to get the belt. And you retained.
Yeah.
And it was an unbelievable finish. And then preceding that, you know, when you're hanging from the, you know, when you hooked your leg in the rungs of the ladder and you were hanging upside down, and a couple of times when y'all had taken them, there was just a couple of bumps using that ladder, and the times you draped yourself over in the corner. But going to the finish, who came up with that finish?
I can't remember.
Dude, because you started sliding down that thing. And
yeah,
he's going to let go.
We were having a tug of war for the title. He had one end of it. I had the other end. And we were both pulling. I almost fall down, and then I kind of come up and push it into his face, so he gets hit with the belt. He falls off. See, the thing I loved about this is that Sean and I worked together to come up with that whole angle with Brian Giewertz, as you would call him as well. And Michael Hayes and then Vince was involved too. But every week we'd show up. Where are we going to go with this? There was never a 7-month plan. It was a week by week. What can we do this week to make it cool? So Sean and I worked so – it's like Lennon McCartney. I don't know what part of the song Paul wrote, the song Lennon wrote. It was just a team effort. So I'm not sure exactly who came up with it. But I do know at that point in time we were both – what about this? How about that? What about this? How about that? So it's probably something that both of us came up with together. I would say that was probably a little bit more Sean, because as you know, Sean was losing. So Sean was always going to make sure he's coming up with something that's great. He's not just going to fall off the ladder.
Oh, yeah.
He, you know, especially at the end.
Because he cares.
Because he cares. And then, once again, he's losing this big blood feud that was involving his family.
Yeah.
So it was just, once again, that's the thing when you do ladder matches now. So much stuff has been done. What can you do that's never been done before? And just the psychology and the drama of that. Like, that's what I loved about that. One more little thing is we had a ladder match, Money in the Bank ladder match last year, I think at SummerSlam or something. It was me, Owen, Zayn, Cesaro, Del Rio, Ambrose.
That was a good match.
It was a good match, but here's what happened. Those guys started getting so obsessed with, like, you got to get powerbombed on the ladder and you got to fall off the top of the Titantron because if we don't do something cool, no one's going to buy it. And I just sat there listening and I threw in this, and finally at one point I just went, it's like Tom Hanks, Captain Phillips. Hey, I'm the captain now. Everything now is going to be decided on and approved by me. If anybody here has any problems, go tell Vince you got a problem with, because I know who's going to side with. You guys are way off base. This is not what a ladder match is about. A ladder match is about this. Climbing, reaching, knock down, climbing. That's all it is. You want to take bumps on the ladder? Go ahead. Not on my watch, not on my match. And we put it together using the drama of the ladder match, and it turned out to be a hell of a contest. It was a great match. And afterwards, I remember Sami Zayn was like, man, you know, you were right. It's like, of course I'm fucking right. Listen to me, you know?
One of the best feelings I ever had in all of my years in the business was passing out in a sharpshooter in Chicago, double turn, and I laid there in a pool of blood. I didn't have to do anything after that but stun the referee while Shamrock and Bret Hart would do a little bit of physicality to further the storyline. And I remember just laying there in a pool of blood, and I was just like, God damn, man, we just hit a grand slam.
Mm-hmm.
No, shit, man, there was five people on base, not just three. That's kind of, and I was just laying there. When you guys both tumble down, you know, and it's over, and everything comes across. I mean, I love the match because the calls were protected. The calls that were made
mm-hmm.
were all protected, but there wasn't a whole lot of communication. Everything mm-hmm. was tight. Everything looked great. Everything came off like it should have, or if it didn't, you covered. What are you feeling at the end of Alpha Omega when that's over? What are you feeling? And you drew money. You fill that house up. Are you just your sense of satisfaction from an accomplishment standpoint? Shawn Michaels, ladder match. You're laying there. The match is over.
Well,
I know what it was for me. What are you feeling?
I mean, I've always been the type of guy where as soon as the bell rings for the finish of the match, I know if it was good or bad to me. I don't need anyone else to tell me. I don't have to go on social media and look up if it was good or bad. I don't need everyone wants, you know, a compliment from, let's say, even Vince.
Oh, sure.
I don't need it. I know if he says it's great and I didn't believe it, I don't care. If he says it sucked and I thought it was great, I can only judge what I feel. But there's those certain nights, and it's something that we all tried for in the business, even with Fozzy, when you do a live show. You hit the jackpot only once in a while. And that's why it's a special night. And both those matches were very special feelings. Now, the Shawn one was a little worse because I had half a tooth mm-hmm. and I was still spitting out pieces of my tooth. So you don't even think about that out there. You just think like, wow, what a match. What a great contest. Amazing. The Omega one, I think there was just – I played real pitch man in that. I wanted to sell tickets. And everything I did leading up to it was selling tickets, selling subscriptions. So the match is almost like, okay, I'll worry about the match when I get there. But when the match is coming closer, now I get that nervousness because, you know, I'm 47 years old, right? And there's a lot of experts going, well, he's never going to keep up with Kenny Omega and they're not going to even do anything. It'll be smoke and mirrors and it'll be fine. But come on, Jericho's 47. I don't think that I'm 47. I never feel that way. I never realized it. I said, 47? Who, me? Let me check my driver's license. Wow, I'm 47. But I know who I am as a performer. And once again, I came in, we met up a couple of days before. I came in with the finish of the match. I came in with the beginning. Kenny had the whole middle. We had a couple little details, switches and stuff. We left a couple of days later. It was the show, changed a couple of things. And dude, we had it. I knew it was going to be great because of what was set up. What you don't know is, once again, the middle things, grabbing the camera, sticking it up. You know, there was one point where we were going to do a move. Someone else did it earlier. Let's just think of it out there. Kenny puts the table on me, jumps off the scaffold, gives me a double foot stomp on the table. That was just all improv. That stuff makes you like, when you improv and it's working, you get off on it. Now, it's the Tokyo Dome, so the sound goes up. I don't know. Like, people aren't really reacting to it. And as a performer, you know, it's like, man, this is good, but the crowd's not really into it. You watch it back, they're going nuts, but you can't hear it in the ring. It's like a WrestleMania in a stadium. So I knew it was good at the end, but I didn't expect it was going to get the type of reviews and feedback that it got.
But just on a personal level, like you said, before all that shit comes in, I mean, you know, you went out there, you gave everything you had, and everything comes out aces.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, and the same thing with 17 with Rock and at the Astrodome, you know, 25 minutes was a heel turn.
You know,
I beat the fuck out him with that chair, you know, and good color and all that stuff. And, you know, I was turning heel. If I could go back and do it again, I'd call an audible, say, Vince, watch a stunner. I've already said that.
And you're right.
But just walking around, even before going into that match, dude, no nerves, no nothing. I knew the mission. I was going to get it done. And we blew the roof off that place. But that, laying in that pool of blood, or just, dude, in any house show, but on the biggest stage, like the stage that you were just on, to me, dude, the satisfaction level when you've crushed it validates all the, well, first of all, we love to be on the road. We love to be in the ring, but you know, all the bullshit that you go through, but man, to be out there, to be able to perform, do something that you love, and then to crush it is the best.
It's the best, but you know, it's funny. And this is something that Ken and I were laughing about when we talked about it the next day, was there were some things in the match that I don't even have to tell you that didn't go the way they were supposed to. And that's what you focus on. Because you don't know, like, until you see it back, and it's like, it didn't even, it made it even, maybe even better.
Yeah.
But at the time, you're like, where the fuck was the referee? What the fuck was he doing? So I'm always thinking about that. But then when I came through, and actually the first guy I saw was Tiger Hattori, longtime New Japan referee, one of the office guys there. He came up to me, he was almost crying. Oh, that was so good, man. Thank you, man. I'm like, really? You thought it was like, oh, the best match? Like, really? Wow. And then someone else comes over and someone else. I'm like, these guys think this is like the best. And then Meltzer, this is the best match of your career. I'm like, wow. So now I'm feeling even better about it. But when I came out of it, I enjoyed it. But I was too busy thinking about the things that didn't work, not realizing that in retrospect, it made it even better. But I knew what we had. And I knew I'd never touched Kenny except for that beatdown in Fukuoka. We never had a match together. I never had a match with Shawn Michaels before WrestleMania 2003, whatever number that was, 18, 19. Sometimes you just get in there with somebody and you got that chemistry. And it's just... easy, easy, easy. Everything of the match was smooth. It was crisp. Like I said, man, I can't even think now anything that I would change. There's one thing that I would change, but that's just being a real super stickler. But other than that, it was a great, great night.
Before we ride off in the sunset, I know you're out here in Los Angeles promoting something. So I want you to talk about what you're out here promoting.
Yeah, man.
And then also talk about where people can find your podcast.
Yeah, it's so there's a show that I did called But I'm Chris Jericho. And I came up with this idea back in 2005 when I got burned out from wrestling. I left. And I came out to LA, not to become a movie star, but to study acting. And I would go into these auditions where there'd be like 15 people that looked kind of like me. And you'd be doing one line for CSI Sheboygan, like, these pretzels are making me thirsty. And then they go, okay, thanks. And I'd be like, that's it. Like, I'm Chris Jericho. Like, I have a fan base. I have a name value. They didn't give a shit. You know, they didn't care. And I was like, what would happen if I got blackballed out of wrestling? And I had to get into acting, and I had no steam, and I had to start from the bottom. So I came up with this idea, But I'm Chris Jericho, and kind of a Curb Your Enthusiasm style Seinfeldian type thing where I'm playing myself an exaggerated version. But what would happen if, you know, if I got, like I just said. So it took me 8 years to sell it, and I sold it back in 2013 to a Canadian company. And it did really good. Won a bunch of film festivals, won LA Film Festival, won one in France. And like, we had a bunch of momentum, and then that's it. It's done. About a year ago, CBC, who's the biggest network in Canada, called me and wanted to do season two. So in season two, Chris now is the fourth lead on Star Crusaders, a really kind of shitty sci-fi show, but he's still pissed off at over-exaggerated prima donna version of myself. And it was so much fun to play because I can play a real dick who always, it's like Archie Bunker. I always get screwed in the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, we had Kevin McDonald and Scott Thompson from the Kids in the Hall. We had Andy Kindler from Bob's Burgers is in it. And like all these great performers. And it's really, really funny. And I had a really good time doing it. And because it's fun to play a version of yourself that you don't usually get to do. You know, like people think, oh, Chris Jericho's going to be the hero and he's got to be. No, this is the opposite. He's just a prima donna. Always kind of angry, and it's just a really fun show that gave me a chance to, as you know, we love comedy, gave me a chance to show this comedic skills that I've learned over the years on kind of the big screen.
So when's that going to be on?
It's on right now. It's ButI'mChrisJericho.com, season two, and you can, if you go there, you see season one, season two, and season one is like 10 bite-size you know, episodes, but season two is a story arc. You start at the beginning, go all the way through to the end. So it's been a big hit, man. Like I said, it's a good way to kind of do something else other than just always wrestling and rock and roll.
Dude, what's that? What happened to There's Nothing Happening Here? What's it called?
Nothing to Report.
Nothing to Report. Jesus Christ. No, I called you. That's so... It was so, I loved it. It was so hokey. It was wonderful.
Same idea.
Because there was nothing going on.
In the same vein. That was two guys, two cops and a stakeout where nothing ever happened, just kind of talking about their own personal problems.
That should have went somewhere.
Dude, it was for Comedy Central, and it was right when their whole infrastructure kind of went to shit. We got caught kind of like, you know, they switched bookers right in the middle of it. Hey, buddy.
Callie's making an appearance here.
Your black lab. Maybe smells my black lab. But yeah, we wanted to do something with it. It did so good. And Comedy Central just kind of dropped the ball on it. But it's fun to do those things. And the thing is nowadays with you know, digital, it's on demand. People, like, it's like, is it on TV? It doesn't have to be.
Right.
You watch it whenever you want, you know. So yeah, but I'm ChrisJericho.com. Check it out and you'll have a couple laughs and it's a lot of fun.
All right, man. You got your podcast. You're done 2 weeks now.
Yeah, 2 week. Talk is Jericho on the Westwood One radio network, which is really cool. Just made a move over there. And, you know, still doing the same thing I do. Keep it diverse. Something that you said when we first started doing this, like, it's not my competition, and what I want to be is Carolla and Joe Rogan and Hardwick and those guys. And that's kind of the shows that I do. Some weeks it's wrestling, some weeks it's rock and roll, some weeks it's comedy, some weeks it's paranormal, whatever I find interesting. So it's been going really good, man.
And last question, what's up with Ozzy? Are you on the road making music right now?
Well, Judas went top five for 10 weeks, biggest hit of our career. We sold like over 100,000 singles, which is this day and age, might as well be like a million. Second single is Painless. That comes out this week. It's already gone top 40. I'm hoping that goes top 10, maybe even top five again, number one. We go out with Steel Panther in Europe January 28th. And then we play here in the States February 20th. We start. We're doing the Whiskey here on March 10th.
No shit, around. Dude. Give me a yell before you come into town because I'll come check you out.
Come join. It'll be
we'll
fun.
We'll do a podcast.
Yeah.
There's got to be a deal. It's like Bailey said. Let's do a deal where we just hang out and shoot the shit.
We've done the podcast now. You're going to do mine after. We got the podcast out of the way. We can just hang out.
We got the podcast out of the way. Callie's ruthless. We're going to try to keep her silent on yours because you actually are a professional. I don't really give a shit. It's all for free. Chris Jericho, awesome guy. We're out.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at podcastone.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. But before I do that, I want to thank my guest, Chris Jericho, for coming by the house at 317 Gimmick Street and shooting a breeze with me, live and in living color, face-to-face, man-to-man, eye-to-eye. It's always good talking to Chris. As a guy, I tell you what, with everything that he's doing, it's hard to outwork Chris. You better get your ass up early in the morning if you want to outwork Chris, one of the hardest working guys I know. Just had a badass match with Kenny Omega over there in Japan for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Everybody's still talking about that. You ought to check that match out if you hadn't seen it. And also, man, that match with Shawn Michaels, that ladder match, was such a smart match. So intelligently laid out. The execution, the finish, the whole nine yards. I love that match. Those are two Chris Jericho classics that you can find real easy, and they're badass and essential watching. Hey man, if you're trying to learn about the business, if you're in the business, even if you're at a high level in the business, you can learn something from watching both of these matches. And if you're just a wrestling fan, these are two awesome matches that you can really sink your teeth in, as they get a lot of time to tell their stories, tell them in a great outstanding building fashion, and deliver on the finish and all of the execution. So I enjoyed both those matches. Y'all go check them out. Hey, I want to say thank you one more time to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. And you can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. And speaking of Podcast One, the new Podcast One app is now available for download at the App Store or Google Play. And there ain't another podcast app like this one anywhere. And that's because the new Podcast One app is loaded with some cool ass features that let you do a lot more than just listen to your favorite shows. You can access behind the scenes photos, articles, and connect with other fans of the shows you like. Watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos. You can actually watch some of your favorite shows in virtual reality. It's like you're sitting right in the damn room with them. So get to the App Store or Google Play and download the new Podcast One app now. Folks, if you want to follow me on social media, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Austin BSR. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.